Okay, we're starting here on Zion Amud Aleph, about 10 lines down by the Meitaveh. Gemara is about to bring a question about the explanation that we gave for the Machloket in the Mishnah. In the Mishnah, we had the position of Rabbi Yossi, which seemed to be a non sequitur from the remainder of the Mishnah. The remainder of the Mishnah is talking about the Nidar and the Nerach. All of a sudden, Rabbi Yossi interjects with the Noder, Marich. It's the person himself taking the Neder, not the object of the Neder or the object of the Arachin. The Gemara says it's clear that Rabbi Yossi is not arguing about this issue, because everybody agrees that a person is being taken out to be executed, can be Noder, can be Marich. That's not the question here. The question that arises here is if he does damage, Im Hizik. If he does damage, then can you make a claim against the Yorshim of the estate of this individual who's being executed? Can you get paid for that hezek that he does on the way to his execution? So we saw the two possibilities about how to explain the machloket, Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef. One way to explain it according to Rabbi Yosef is b'milve al peh govim mina yorshim kamiflege. And then Rabbi said that everybody agrees that milve al peh, you cannot be gove. The question here is that if it's milve aktuva b'torah, k'ktuva b'shtar damyo. It's as if it's written in a shtar or not written in a shtar. So the machloket is the din of hezek that's written in the Torah, the equivalent of having a documented loan that you can go and claim against the estate. So that was the way we concluded. The Gemara also brought that same explanation of Rabba and Rav Yosef with regards to another paraita that we have. Now we're at the Meitaveh. How chefer bor b'shut harabim. Someone was digging a pit in the Rishut harabim. V'nafal alav shor v'harago. So they dig in the pit. A shor is going by, falls into the pit that he's digging, and kills him. Patur. The Baal HaShor is Patur. Vlo'ot. El Shem Meit HaShor. Not only is the Baal HaShor Patur in terms of compensating the individuals digging the bor, but Shem Meit HaShor, Yoshei Baal HaBor, Chayavim L'Shalem, Dmei Shor LeBaalav. That not only that, but if the shor itself dies because of this impact, then the Yorshei Baal HaBor, the inheritors of this individual who was digging the pit, have to pay for the shor. Dmei Shmor LeBaalav, they have to pay the value of the shor back to its owners. So this is our case. This is exactly our case, which is you have an individual who did damage while he was dying or being executed. Over here he's dying because the shor falls on him and kills him, but he's also damaged the shor at the same time because the shor got injured or damaged or died because he fell into the bor b'shut harabim. So does he have to compensate or not? Is there an obligation? He's obviously not nemad b'din. He didn't stand b'din yet, so then is there an obligation? Here we have a suggestion that yes, he has to pay for their monies. If that's the case, it's a problem for Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef. But the argument here is about milveh aktuva b'torah kamiflegeh, that they're arguing about whether that's considered to be a milveh ketuva b'shtar or not. Over here, it's clear from this braita that it is. And according to Rabbi's explanation, then how do you explain Rabbi Yosef in our Mishnah? Now, truthfully, it could even be a question on Rabbi Yosef. Equally a good question on Rabbi Yosef as it is in Rabbi, which is, here you see that you have to pay. And there's no question about it. So then how could you set up the machloket in a manner which says that they can't pay? Rashi brings down here that there are others who said that this was a question on Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Because Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar's opinion was that im chaval becherim patur. Rashi rejects that explanation. He says, what's the question? Tano hu upolik. Shimon ben Elazar is a Tano. So what, that we found another brighter that argues on him? Why is that a big deal? He's a Tano. The Tano of a brighter is a Tano. They argue. That's fine. The problem we have is with Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef, who are Amoraim, who are explaining our Mishnah in this manner. Now they're creating a situation where there's a machloket between the Tana of our Mishnah and the Braita. So maybe Enoch and Ami could be that way, but why would you set up a situation when we have a clear Braita that tells you what the outcome is? Why would you set up the Mishnah in such a machloket where we have an answer ready from the Braita? So now the first answer that's given, and you have to realize that chronologically this answer is not really relevant to the question on Rabba. This is a discussion independent of this, because the answer is Amar Abila Amar Rav. This is quoting from Ilam Amar Rav, and the question was on Rabba, who is much later than Rav. He lives 3-4 generations after Rav. So it has to be Kishamad Bedin, that the Baal HaBor, the one who was digging the bor, already stood before Beitin, and they were mechayivim to pay for the shor. How could that be? The Braita says, Vahaharago Ketani. The Braita says that he was killed. So it can't be that he stood in din if he's already dead. No, he's still alive. The shore falling on him made him into a trefa. So he's a walking dead man. Since he's a walking dead man, we can be ma'amid him bedin. We can bring him to Beit Din to adjudicate the case with regards to the nezek done to the shore. But as far as the damage that's done to him, that the shore made him into a treifa, there he's as if dead, it's as if he killed him. Vama Rav Nachman, Tani Chagol. The Rav Nachman says that in this Braita we had from Chagol's version of the Braita, mate ukvaro. Not only did he die, the person, but the shore buried him. Meaning that there were piles of dirt around the bore that he was digging, and the shore kicked the dirt in and landed on him, so he killed him and he buried him in one shot. Halacha is that the Dayanim are sitting around the bore. So they're able to adjudicate the case while he's down in the bore, and they pask him that he has to give the money. So that's the answer. The answer, again, is not directed towards Rabbah's explanation of our Mishnah. Happens to be they're trying to work out that Braita. For different reasons, they're trying to work out what the explanation of that Braita is. But in the end, the solution to that problem, or the explanation they give for the Braita, will also reconcile us with Rabbah's explanation of our Mishnah, which is that now you have a Beit Din sitting around the boar. So when he dies inside, they paskind already that he's chayav the nezek, and therefore we're already post-psakdin. Post-psakdin, everybody agrees, then there's an obligation for the Yoshim to pay. Pre-psakdin, that's what our Mishnah is dealing with. That was the machloket in the Mishnah, according to Rabbah Yosef, is before the psakdin, is he chayav or not? This Braita is dealing with a totally different case. It's after the psakdin. And the Havamina would have been, as Tosafot points out, that the Baal HaShor has to be there, he has to stand next to his shore. The end, the conclusion is, no, that the Beit Din being around the mouth of the boar is sufficient in order to give a Psak Alocha, that this individual is Chayav the Nezek, and that will allow the Nizak to take reparations from the estate of this person who was killed. Tan Rabbanan. Hayutzei Hareg, Mazin Alav Midam Chatzato Midam Hashamo. Person is being taken out to be executed. We do bring his korban chatat and his korban asham in the mikdash, because an individual chatat shemetu balea is put to death. Asham has the same din, except it's yotzei liriyah, goes out to graze. So the chatat and the asham are meaningless, useless after he dies. So they have to be brought prior to his death. So here, where he's being executed, while he's being taken out to execute, we do perform the chatat and asham that he has. Now, chata botosha in his kakim lo. If he does a chait at that moment, we don't regard it, we don't worry about him. For instance, if he did some sort of chait bishogeg, at that moment he's chayav a chatat, we don't wait for him to be mafresh a chatat, to bring the chatat on his behalf, and hold off executing him. My time, that's inuy adin. He's being taken out to execution. We don't all of a sudden stop the execution to allow him to do a chatat, because that drags out the execution, and we try to move as fast as possible between the Gemar Din and the execution. The moment of Gemar Din until the execution, we try to make that amount of time as small as possible in order that there should not be mental anguish for the person who's being executed. So here we don't want to delay the execution for him to bring his Chatat. The Reisha also says that we wait around for to sprinkle the blood of the Chatat, sprinkle the dam of the Asham. How come we're waiting around? That's Inui Adin. So my answer is, they already shechted his chatat, they already shechted his asham, we just have to sprinkle the blood, so we go ahead and do it. If it wasn't shechted yet, what's the din? Lo! Then we wouldn't bring the korban on his behalf. Zemar says, then adatani chatat ba'oto sha'a in his kakim lo. If you want to break down the Braita gave a case where yes, we do it, a case where we don't do it. You could have made a much finer distinction. You could have said, Liflo gulitne bidido. Then let's split it up inside. Bamed v'mamurim, when is it true that by a korban that we bring it, sheyazivah zavuach votoshah, if it was already shechted. But, avalein zivzevach zavuach, if it wasn't shechted yet, lo, then we wouldn't do it. That would have been a much finer distinction than the distinction that we made in the Braita. So Mar says, achanami kamar, that's exactly what it's saying. Bamed v'mamurim, when is it true that we sprinkled the dama chatat or the dama sham for him, sheyazivah zavuach, it was already ready, we shechted it, and it just left to sprinkle the blood, that will do on his behalf. Botosha, aval, ein zevach zavuach, if it's yet to be shechted, nase kemisha chata, botosha. That's equivalent of someone who sinned at that time. We don't pay attention, we don't deal with that issue, because we do not want to be me'ane et ha-din. So therefore, in order to facilitate the ability to bring the korban before he's executed, if it's shechted already, we go ahead and we finish off the korban before he's executed, because that's very little time. Plus, he'll get the benefit of the chatat and asham being brought before he dies. But, even more involved in the process, whether that means simply that it hasn't been shechted yet, or even more involved is he sins now, he's got to be mafrish his chatat v'asham, that we don't allow because of the inui hadin. Because the problem of dragging out the time period between the Gemar Din and the execution. All right, new Mishnah. Haisha Shiatza Liareg. A woman is being taken out to be executed. Ein Mamtinin La Sheteled. We do not wait until she gives birth to execute her. Haisha Shiashva La Mashber. The woman already is on the birthing stone, meaning she's beginning to give birth. Mamtinin La Sheteled. So then we wait until she gives birth. When that transpires, Rashi claims is Yeshva La Mashber. Kodem Shenigmar Dina. That's only before the Gemar Din. Tosafot takes issue with that right away and says, no, what do you mean before the Gemar Din? All these situations that we're speaking about situations between Gemar Din and the execution. And this mission is no different. Before the Gemar Din, there's no question that we would let her give birth. This whole din of we're going to kill her, we're going to execute her despite the fact that she is pregnant, only relates to the fact of execution. It doesn't relate to the fact before the Gemar Din. And therefore, Tosafot explains, says, Inu Adin only applies between Gemar Din and execution. So we don't wait around for her to give birth after the Gemar Din, because that's going to be a long time. It's going to drag out the execution. It could be months. So therefore, we don't do it. We execute her with the baby. On the other hand, if she's already giving birth, then we say, finish it off. Let her give birth, because it's not going to be an extended period of time. She'll give birth, and then we can execute her. But if it's before the Gemar Din, we can always wait until you give the Gemar Din. There's no such thing as Inu Idin before the Gemar Din. Inu Idin only applies after Gemar Din. So you have a machloket Rashi and Tosafot as to when this situation of Isha Yeshua Lamashber relates to. Isha Shnerga, a woman who is killed, Nenim Bisara, we can benefit from her hair. Her hair is Mutter Bahana. Behemah Shnerga, an animal that was killed, Asura Bahana. Tear is not mutar ba'ana. That we'll deal with in the latter part of the daf today. So Gemara, pshita, it's simple. Of course you're going to kill her with the vlad. Gufahi, they're a singular unit. They are together one unit. We don't look at them as separate entities. So therefore, of course, if she is going to be executed, the baby is going with her. Gemara says, istrich, we need it. Salkadat kamina oviktiv, kasha yashit alav bala isha. Because in another context, the mishpatim, if someone knocks into a pregnant woman or hits a pregnant woman and causes her to miscarry, the person who did that has to pay the husband of this woman compensation for the miscarriage. So it would seem that the fetus in the woman really belongs to her husband. It's really the monetary ownership of her husband. So I would have thought, Mimona de Balhu, Vo lifts the demine. It's her husband's money, and therefore we shouldn't cause him a loss over here. Kamash Valan, that we disregard the fact that the husband has a monetary interest here, and the priority is given to the execution, and therefore we execute the woman despite the fact that the husband will lose out monetarily over here. Why says, hey, Machanami, why don't we say we do wait? Why don't we take the interest of the husband into consideration here? Why don't we protect his ownership in the fetus? I'm Rabbi Abou, I'm Rabbi Yochanan, I'm Rakra, Umeitu Gamshnehem. It's talking about niyuf, talking about an illicit relationship. And over there it says, Metu gam shnehem, they both shall die. The rabot at the vlad comes to include the fetus. Because it's obvious that a noef, no effet, that who else is going to get killed? Of course they're both going to be killed. They both did something illicit, and therefore they both have to die. So why do you have to write Metu gam shnehem? The Metu gam shnehem tells us not only does the woman die, but even if she's pregnant, she dies with the vlad, with the fetus. It says, Vabim Baile. We already have used that Metu gam shnehem for another limud. Achu shnehem shavim divrei Rabbi Yoshia. Rabbi Yoshia says that it says Metu gam shnehem is only when they're both on the same plane. That means that they both have to be gdolim. If one of them is a minor, if either the woman or the man is a minor, then there is no din of Metu gam shnehem. They both will not be put to death, and therefore the party that is a gadol will also not be put to death. Metu gam shnehem means that they both have to be of age in order to be chayav. Ki kamart, the Rabbanan respond, mi gam. That you could have learned out to metu shnehem. What is gam shnehem? Gam is a ribui. So that ribui tells us, not only do they have to be of the same age, meaning both be culpable over here, but also the Rabbanan vlad, that if the woman is executed over here, there might be two that are executed, not just her, but the vlad, the fetus, alongside of her. Right, yeshva la mashber, if she already sat down to give birth, then we wait and let her give birth. My time, huh? Came into Akar, Gufa Achrinahu. The moment that the fetus starts to come out, it's now considered to be a separate entity. So once she's already reached the point of labor, the fetus is now considered or classified as a separate entity. And because it's a separate entity, therefore, we can't kill the baby anymore. Baby is no longer subject to the execution of the mother because it's a separate entity. And therefore, we let her give birth, and then only afterwards do we execute her. So now, I'm Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Aisha Ayutzali Areik. Woman who's being taken out to be executed. Makinota Keneged Beit HaHeriyon. We hit her opposite the area of the womb. Kidei Shimot Avlad. Tchila. In order that she will miscarry. Kidei Shalot Avod Yidei Nivu. So that she will not become embarrassed or disgusting at the execution. Our fear is that when the woman is executed, then she will miscarry after the execution and she'll be left in a mess. So we take care of that beforehand so that she should not be left in that nivul. Lememro. So the suggestion is here, the hikat maumeita bereisha, that she dies first. Baha kaivalan, the vlad mait bereisha, the baby or the vlad always dies first. The way that Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel phrase it, it says that after she's executed, she might miscarry, which suggests that the fetus outlives her. She dies, and then only afterwards does the fetus die, and then it comes out afterward. Because over here it says that if we don't do this, kadesh lo tovad li'dei nivul, she'll be minuval. So the nivul means that she'll be dead, and then after she's dead, the baby will come out. So it suggests that the baby's exiting of the woman only happens after she's dead, and that means that the baby died later, and that's why it's exiting afterwards. The assumption being that as soon as the baby dies, it miscarries, it comes out. If that's the case, then the suggestion is that she could die prior to the fetus. We have a principle that the baby always dies first. It's none. Tinok ben yomo nochelo manchil. When it comes to a baby that's 1 day old, he inherits, and he's able to give inheritance to others. Rav Sheshet says this has relevance. Benochel ben nixayim, inheriting his mother, manchil la'achim in av, to give over to his brothers from the father. Of course, in terms of his ability to pass inheritance, Etinok ben Yomo has no inheritors, in the sense that he has no children, and therefore the only inheritors are relatives of his father. Only inheritors are relatives of his father. They will inherit whether he's there or not there. His birth, his existence, makes absolutely no difference in terms of the inheritance. So the fact that the Mishnah says, Nochel Manchil, can't be relevant to the father's Yerusha, because the father's Yerusha will pass to whomever it is, whether or not he's there. He has no impact on that. The only question is with the inheritance of his mother. We know that a child inherits his mother. That's Ketubat Benin Dichrin. Since the child inherits his mother, therefore, he will inherit his mother. And once it's his, then when he dies, it's passed to his family. His family is determined by the father. So his brothers from the father will inherit him. The brothers from the father would not have been entitled to his mother's Yerusha, because she wasn't their mother. They were born from another mother. So since they were the product of another mother, they don't share a common mother, they wouldn't have inherited this woman. But now that he's born, and he inherits his mother, after he dies, he passes it to his brothers from the father. So the situation here is, again, must be, the mother passed away, and the fetus is born. So the question of how that happens, the Gemara says there, Davka ben Yom Echad, only when he's a day old. So that the woman died after he was already born. Aval Ubar, lo, if it was a fetus, not. Dahava Mayit Vereisha, because we're certain that the fetus died before the mother. If the mother died and the baby's yet to be born, then it could have been that the mother died and the fetus inherited her, and then he died. Why do you have to say that it was the other order? The Gemara says, because we know for a fact that if the mother died, the fetus automatically died first. The fetus dies first, and he's not inheriting his mother. He can only inherit his mother once she passed away. And she only passes away after the fetus has passed away. And once he's dead, he can't be a yoresh of the mother. The yerusha from the mother is only if you're alive, not if you are dead. So therefore, to pass it on to his brothers. So from here we see that the fetus always precedes the death. The death of the fetus always precedes the death of the mother. So Mar says, Hani Mile, this becomes important. We actually saw this in Chulin. In the Mishnah in Chulin, when we talk about an animal that is a Ben Tisha Chai, a live birth of a 9-month-old after the mother shechted. You shecht the mother and then we find a live baby inside. How could that be? Rashi over there discusses in the cases of Meita that for sure the Ubar always died before the mother. So how do you reconcile over there that the you shecht the mother and then all of a sudden you find a Ben Tisha Chai inside of it? How could you find a live fetus if you shechted the mother? The fetus always precedes, the death of the fetus always precedes the death of the mother. So Gemara's answer here is equally relevant here as it is to there, which is Hanemile the Gabi Mita. That's if she dies natural causes. That since the fetus is so small, the tipa, the poison of the Malach HaMavet, comes and cuts his simanim. Or, in other words, when the mother dies, the fetus is dependent on the mother for its sustenance. If the mother is dying for natural causes, in the preservation of her life, she will prioritize, the body automatically prioritizes the mother over the fetus. And therefore, to let the fetus die, or the nutrition or the sustenance that the mother is providing to the fetus will be terminated before it terminates for itself. So the mother's body will give priority to her over the fetus, and that's why the fetus will die before the mother. On the other hand, in a case of Nehargav, she's killed, Nehargahim, Meita Bereisha, she can die first. If the death is all of a sudden, there's a sudden death of the woman, then there was no continuum in which the mother was weakening, and therefore the fetus died, and then the mother died. Over here, it happened all of a sudden. So the fetus could have been totally fine, and then all of a sudden the mother's life is taken. So that's true by the execution over here. That's also true by the shechita of the mother. When you shech the mother, the fetus could still be alive, because you're killing the behemah. The behemah did not die. So this is only relevant when the mother died. Over here, she's being executed. When she's executed, it's a possibility that the fetus will outlive her, and that's why it'll be discharged after her death. The fetus will be discharged, which will be something that is menuval. Rabbi says, v'ha'av u'vda. We have case material that says the opposite. The case where a woman died, uparkis ad klat pirkuse, and the fetus was still moving inside of her. Rabbi says, mitahava azanav halita'a debefarkeset. Just like the tail of a lizard. Take the tail of a lizard, you pop it off, the tail of the lizard continues to wag and wiggle even after it's severed from the lizard. Now that's a protection mechanism for the lizard, so that the predator thinks that he got the prey because it's still wiggling in his mouth. He thinks he's got the lizard. Meantime, the lizard takes off and leaves the tail behind. But the tail moving is not a sign of life. It moves because of the electronic impulses that were sent by the lizard before it severed from the lizard. So to over here, the baby's still moving. It's dead, but it's moving because of the electronic impulses that were sent before its death. So just the fact that it moves is not an indication of life. Just like the expression, a chicken running around a chicken without its head, even after you shech the chicken continue to run around because the electronic impulses sent from the head are still in the body, even after the head is severed. So to over here, even though the fetus was really dead, nevertheless, it would still moved around afterwards. Right, Amar Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel. Haisha sheyashva lamashber umeita. So if a woman is giving birth, and she dies in the pangs of birth, Bishabbat, it's on Shabbat, mevin sakin umikarin et kreisa umutzin et vlad. We tear her open and get the vlad out in order to save the life of the vlad. Where it says, pshita. Why not? Mayovit. What would be the Isser on Shabbos to cut into the woman to see if the vlad is open? We have a suffix whether the vlad is alive or not. We do not know. The woman's dead now. So now we're going to be violating the Shabbos to cut her open in order to get the vlad out. We violate the Shabbos to get out this vlad. Mar says, what violation of Shabbos is there now? If the woman is dead already, is passed away, ma'avid, mechatech v'bosarhu. It's just cutting flesh. The only restriction against cutting into a human being is if the human being is alive. If the human being's alive, then blood comes out. There's a problem of, like by shechita, shechting, cutting, chovel b'shabbat, this chayav. That's only if the person's alive. Once the person's dead, cutting into them is not considered to be chovel on Shabbat. So you're not going to be chayav for cutting into a dead being. Can you violate hotza'ah on Shabbat to bring a knife through the reshut rabim in order to cut this woman over to see if we can save the fetus? So what is he telling us now? That when you have a suffix, pikuach nefashot, your mechalo shabbat, tanina. That's a straightforward mishnah in Yoma. Mi, shnafla alav mapolet. If a building collapses on an individual, safek husham, safek enusham. We don't know if he was in it or wasn't in the building. Safek chai, safek meit. We don't know if he's alive or not. Safek knani, safek Yisrael. We don't know if it's a non-Jew or Jew. Mechavina alav et agal. We remove it, no matter what. On safek nefashot, we're violating, as Yom Kippur, Shabbos, we violate anything in order to save a life. So ma'u d'teima, what I have thought, hotam hu d'hava lei chazaka d'chiyuta. Over there, by the case of the building collapsing on someone, the chazaka is that they were alive. But last time we saw them, last time we knew them, they were alive. Over here, we never saw the fetus alive yet. So we're uncertain. We're uncertain even if we have a live being whatsoever. So maybe we shouldn't violate the Shabbat in order to try to save this life. So he says, that we do. We save the life of the fetus even though it doesn't have a chezkat chiyuta. We never knew that it was alive. We're not certain that this baby is even a viable baby. Nevertheless, we violate the Shabbat in order to save this baby. So now, in terms of the baby that's being born here, how could the mother die prior to the baby being born? You have to give one of two answers. Either that the woman dying in childbirth is the equivalent of neharga, or you have to say that once the woman sits on the mashbir, we saw that already before, that they're considered to be trei gufa. They're two entities, and therefore the fetus is no longer dependent on the mother. It's not dependent on the mother. When the mother dies, it's not going to impact whether the fetus dies or not. So those are the two possibilities I would answer this piece of the Gemara, so that it's not a question to the conclusion we had before between Nerga and Meta. But the important thing that comes out of this Gemara is pretty central in the issue of abortion. This Gemara sits at the forefront of the machloket between the poskim, the modern day poskim, with regards to abortion. The major machloket, the most famous of machloket, is between Rav Moshe and the Tzitz Eliezer. Rav Moshe says that abortion is never permitted. There are no circumstances where abortion is permitted, except, and that's the one that's mentioned in the Mishnah and Olot, is where the mother's life is endangered. Only when the mother's life is endangered do we allow the abortion to take place in order to save the life of the mother, because the fetus is considered to be a rodef. And therefore, we save the mother's life at the expense of the fetus. Again, that's as long as lo ne'akar rosho, as long as his head hasn't appeared, come out. Once his head comes out, then they're on equal footing, and we do not take the life of the fetus in order to protect the mother's life. But that's basic. Everybody agrees to that point, that when it is permitted, when there's sakanat nefashot to the mother. The question arises in extenuating circumstances. Circumstances in which the Tzitz Eliezer speaks about is, for instance, Tay-Sachs. There's a Tay-Sachs baby. Can you abort a Tay-Sachs baby? Or, in the case of rape, chas v'shalom, can you abort the baby because of the mental anguish of the caring mother? Now, first we have to establish that the mental anguish of the mother is sufficient grounds for doing anything, which we've seen before. There's a Tosafot in Baba Kama that says there that busha, embarrassment, which is a psychological chezek, ain't no pachot me physical damage. The Tosafot says that psychological damage is as bad or on equal footing as physical damage. That's number one. And number two is that we see, and it's opened up much more recently in the poskim, the idea that psychological impact or damage is really something that we have to consider within the halachic realm, whether it means violating Shabbat, whether it means other halachic dispensations when it comes to those psychological impacts, that we have to be careful. Again, it's much harder, it's a much grayer area, but it's something that's being addressed more and more. So the question here is, by those psychological impacts, is one allowed to abort the Tzitz Eliezer? The machloket revolves around partly our Gemara over here. Our Gemara says that before you take the woman out to execute her, makinoto, you hit her, and then she discharges the fetus. So that means that you're allowed to kill the fetus before the woman is executed. Why are you allowed to kill the fetus? The reason you can kill the fetus can be for one of two reasons. Moshe says the reason that you can kill the fetus, Moshe Feinstein says, is because it's dead. A woman who's being taken out to be executed is considered to be a walking dead. If someone were to kill her at that point, they would not be chayav mita, because they're already considered to be dead. So too, the fetus is already considered as if dead. And therefore, there's no question of killing the fetus over here. On the other hand, the other possibility of why you're allowed to kill the fetus is because the fetus is not classified as a being. There's no isur of killing a fetus. Now, this relates to a Gemara in Perek Ben Sororo Mareh in Sanhedrin. Over there, the Gemara says that there's a restriction against the Ben Noach who kills a fetus, because it says, Shofech Dam Hadam Ba'adam. And over there, the Gemara learns that Shofech Dam Hadam Ba'adam means even inside of an individual, if you kill them, you're Chayav Mita. The Gemara has a principle over there that it can't be that a Ben Noach has something that's more chamur than a Ben Israel. How can it be that a Ben Noach has something more stringent than a Ben Israel? The Gemara has mafil that principle in a number of times there in the Sugya of Ben Noach. That it can't be that the Ben Noach has a different halacha than the Jew. It might be the punishment's different, it might be that the outcome's different, but it can't be something's usher for a Ben Noach and mutter for a Jew. That's inconceivable. So over here we see that the killing of a fetus is asur. For a Jew it also must be asur. The question is, what's the nature of that isur? Is the nature of the isur that it's considered killing for a Ben Noach, and therefore for a Jew it's also to be considered killing? Or is it simply just an isur? The Kal v'chomer tells us, if it's also for Ben Noach, it must be also for Israel. It could be an isur aseh, it could be any type of isur. And therefore, in extenuating circumstances, can we violate that isur? If you think it's murder, then obviously not. If you think it's murder, you can't do that. But on the other hand, if you don't think that it's murder, then there might be in certain extenuating circumstances that you're allowed to violate that isur, which is the position of the Tzitz Eliezer versus Rav Moshe, who says it's always murder. But our Gemara plays that prominent role. How do you view our Gemara over here? That is also aided and abetted by the situation over here, which is you're allowed to violate Shabbos for the fetus. What does that mean? How do you reconcile between the fact that you're allowed to violate Shabbos to save the fetus, which means that it's a live being, because you're allowed to violate Shabbos for something that's a living entity, then also say that it's not murder? The two seem to be hand in hand. And that relates, there's a Tosafot in Sanhedrin that relates that, and the Shita Mekubetzet actually brings it over here, and this Shita Mekubetzet is prominent in this Machloket. If you look here on Dav Zayin Amin Aleph, in the Shita Mekubetzet, Othei, if you look down in the wide lines, as the Shita Mekubetzet gets wider, by the dot over there, it says, V'kashami matnitan da'olot. There's a question on this Gemara from the Mishnah in Olot, the mighty love of Perak Ben Sorero Moreh, and it's brought, quoted in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Isha ha-mekashel le'led. Woman is having trouble giving birth. Mechatchin ubar shevimeah. We save the woman's life by killing the fetus. Motzino to Avraver, and we take him out piecemeal. Mipnei shechayah kodmim lechayav. Her life takes precedence over the life of the fetus. Yetzar rosho. Once his head exits, eno gimbo. We don't touch the fetus anymore. Alma kozman shlotzi rosho mutar laharago. This is this Shita Megillah. Sounds like this from this Mishnah, as well as the Gemara that's quoted in Sanhedrin, that as long as the fetus has not exited, you can kill it. V'yesh lamar, dolam utar lahorgo. You're right. You can always kill a fetus. V'ha dimamtinin la mishum memona debal. And why do we wait around over here? How come once she is giving birth, or why do we wait for her to give birth over here? It's because of the husband's interest in the fetus. Im lav kro devi umeitu kam shnehem. Had it not been for the pasuk umeitu kam shnehem, which overrides that issue of the husband's ownership over here, we would have let her give birth for the monetary means of the husband, not because the fetus is considered to be a living entity. Umi ukasha, kevin de mutar laharago, amai mechalad limavet ha-shabbat. If it's mutar to kill the fetus, because the fetus is not considered to be a living being, then how can the Gemara now, we just said, be say you can be mechalad shabbat to save the fetus? How do you reconcile those two things? Kidamrina bishmaite, number of alo nitzurcha, yokach nireh, the chashiv kesafek pikuach nifashot. It's only a safek pikuach nifashot. Afilo achi mutar lahorgo, and therefore you're still allowed to kill it. Ubematitin daola dofim sachay nefesh mipnei nefesh vaday umatzilin etimo b'mitato. Vachaminim bekosis. The Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira, Perak ben Tzurer Omer, the bedin bnei Adam horgo patur mechalulim et haShabbat. Ad kolshon haRosh veTosafot. He's quoting the Rosh, the Tosafot. That is quote. It's a Rosh that quotes the Tosafot in Sanhedrin about this issue by a goseis, which, if you kill him, you're not chayev mita. On the other hand, if it's a violation of Shabbat, you're allowed to be mechalal Shabbat. So you can see that the two are not necessarily correlated. How do I reconcile between the fact that sometimes, if you kill them, you're not considered as if you're a murderer, yet on the other hand, you're allowed to be mechalal Shabbat? So here he says it's the same issue over here. This fetus is not necessarily considered to be alive. Not to consider it to be a live entity, it's a fake nefesh, it's a quasi-human being. Since only a quasi-human being, there's no isur of hariga. Nevertheless, that's not the threshold for saving them on Shabbat. And then you will save the entity, even though it's not a full being. So for this Shita Mekubetzet, it sounds like, it's not considered murder to kill a fetus. And that's, again, the makor, the background for some of those that are matir in extenuating circumstances for abortion. Now, Rav Moshe is faced with some difficulties because there are tshuvot, the tshuvot, the yaivots, which is very difficult. Even in the Tzitz Eliezer, who thinks that you can use abortion in extenuating circumstances, says that the yaivots is difficult. There's also a marit. In the marit, it's seen as a tshuva that seems to support the position of the Tzitz Eliezer. Rav Moshe, and there's also a tosafot in Sanhedrin that seems to support his position. In both cases, Rav Moshe says that it must be a told so fair, or as in Tami To'er wrote it. Has to be a Talmud Sofer, or some mistaken Talmud wrote, this is definitely not a tshuva from the Marit, he would never say such a thing. Tzitz Eliezer, after he got the tshuva from Moshe, writes back again, arguing in favor of his position and showing how it's not, that it's quoted by the Knesset Agdolah, who's a Talmud Muvak of the Marit, and he quotes both tshuvot, so on and so forth. This machloket, this stream machloket, about whether the aborting of a child is classified as murder or not murder, and the nafkamino will be in extenuating circumstances whether we permit the aborting of a child, that Tzitz Eliezer was willing to be matir, but Moshe Feinstein said under no circumstances are we matir, And generally, I think that the halacha ruvachat in Klal Yisrael is that we follow the position of Moshe Feinstein, that it's not allowed in any of these circumstances, in any of these situations. Just a little insight, not the whole sugya, but just to show how our Gemara is relevant to that much larger sugya. Continuing in the Gemara, Ashashin Neraga, Vamai, why a woman who is killed, is her hair mutar ba'ana? It's Irehana Ninu, it's Isra'ana. Because we know that a mate is a surba na'a. That we learn out from Miriam, but Tamat Shiram Miriam, we have a Xerisha of a Sham Sham to a Egla Rufa. Just like an Egla Rufa is a surba na'a, so too a mate is a surba na'a. So why can you get benefit from her hair? So Amarav, Belmeret, Tnu Sari, Leviti. Give my hair to my daughter. She gives her last will and testament. She says before she's being let out to be executed, give my hair to my daughter. Rama says, Ilu Amra Tnu Yadi Leviti, mi avinina. She said, give my arm to my daughter, will you listen to her? That doesn't make any sense. Just because she gives us a command to give her hair, why should that have any impact on the situation? If she said, give her arm, we wouldn't impact the situation. So I'm a papa, I'm a rab, but pay a nochrit. Rab says, the answer here is that it's a wig. It's not really her hair, it's a wig. And therefore, taima da amra tnu. If she says, give the wig, then we say that the wig is separate from her and we give it to the daughter. Hello, amra tnu. Has she not indicated to give it to her, then gufaho, it becomes a part, a single part of her entity, umitzar, and then it's asur ba'na'am. So the default is that the pe'an achrit, the wig is considered to be one with the woman. Since it's one with the woman, it becomes part of the isurei ana'a when the maid dies. But if she indicates beforehand that she wants it separated from her, give it to my daughter, then she already breaks it away as a separate entity, and it doesn't take on the isurei ana'a of a mate, and you can give it to the daughter. That's Rav's solution to the problem. Just in terms of what a pe'a nochrit is, we translate it loosely as a wig. Rashi over here gives a description of it, which is not exactly like how we think of wigs. It says, "Rigilot hayu nashim kisasar an mu'at." When their hair was thin, or like a short, "Likshort se'ar nashim nachriot." They used to take hair from other women. "Lisa'aran v'hu pe'a nachrit." And they used to be koleya, Rashi says in other places. They weaved it, or they braided it into their hair, in order to extend their hair, or to thicken out their hair. It's interesting, not like what we have, the wigs here, where it's a separate entity that sits on top, but rather that it was weaved into the hair of the woman herself, or braided into the hair of the woman herself, when she either had thin hair, or short hair. So that's Rav's answer. Rav says that we're dealing with a wig. Didn't Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina have this question? The hair of the righteous woman, what is the din? And Rava says that the question Rabbi Yossi is asking is, what do we do with the wig? So what are these nashim tzidkaniyot? These nashim tzidkaniyot we're speaking about is an irad nidachat. An irad nidachat, everybody in the city is put to death because they were convinced to worship Avodah Zarah, and they followed that person that led them down the road to worship Avodah Zarah, and they worship Avodah Zarah. We kill out the entire city. All of its inhabitants, plus all of their money, all their possessions are burnt. That's only for those that worship the Avodah Zarah. Those that did not worship Avodah Zarah, their lives are saved, but their possessions go down with the rest of the Irani Dachat are burnt. So the Gemara says in other places that a person who did not worship Avodah Zarah, he goes out naked, basically. He has to leave everything behind and goes out naked. His goof is saved, but nothing else. So the question here is about a Nashim Tzidkaniyot, these righteous women who did not follow the city and worship Avodah Zarah. They're leaving town. Are they allowed to take their wig with them or not? How one with their body do we consider the wig that is there? Is the wig part of their body, therefore they can leave with it? Or is the wig considered possession, has to stay behind and be burnt? So that's the question Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina is presenting. So if Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina has a question, how come Rav is so sure over here that a pe'an achrit is considered to be one with the woman unless she indicates otherwise? So Gemara says there's a difference in their question. It's only if it's hanging on a peg in the house. If the wig is hanging in a peg on the house, what do we consider it? Do we consider the wig to be still a part of the woman? Is it considered to be gufa? It's like her goof and she can take it out? Or is that considered to be a possession? Over here, she's wearing the wig. So taima d'amratnu, it works. Alo amratnu, gufaho umitzar. So Rav's position about the fact that a wig is considered to be one with the woman is when she's wearing the wig. That is definitely she's one with the woman unless she indicates otherwise. When it's hanging in the house on the peg, that's the question Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina says. That wig, what's the classification of the wig? Does it belong to the woman, the body of the woman, and everybody can leave with her? Does it belong to her possessions, and therefore it's left behind and burnt with the remainder of the city? So they're dealing with different issues, different cases about Pe'a Nachrit. Okay, Kashalei Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak doesn't like the way that Rav set up our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that the woman is just like an animal. Just like over there, it's considered, we're talking about the animal itself. We're not talking about a wig that the animal is wearing. Also over here, we got to be talking about the woman herself, not the wig that the woman is wearing. The difference between a woman and a behema, and here we're talking about her hair and the hair of the behema is. Zu mitata osrata, v'zu gmar dina osrata. Question is, what causes the item to become asur ba'ana'a? For the behema, the isur ba'ana'a starts the moment there's a gmar din. So this is the psak halacha, this behema is going to be put to death, then that behema is asur ba'ana'a from that point forward. We know that if you shech the animal at that point, it's not a kosher shechita, because the animal is already considered to be isur ba'ana'a. On the other hand, the isur ba'ana'a by a woman only transpires at mita, at the time of death. And as Rashi points out, Isha mitata usrata, v'seir la bar mitahu, shein asu lishtanot. Hair doesn't die. If death is what causes the isra, I know it has to be a part of the body that die, that change form. Over here, the hair doesn't change forms afterwards. It doesn't die with the woman. And therefore, it's not nesra by mitata. He explains why there is a difference. In the end, he explains why the halacha is different. Even though we're talking about the hair of the animal and the hair of the woman, why is it that the hair of the woman is mutar? Before we said that can't be. Anything about attached to a mate is asur. The answer is hair is different. The only time that the isur hanoah that comes out of a mate is when she dies. But that's only things that are impacted by death. Hair is not impacted by death, so therefore it doesn't become asur bana. But then by behema, it's not the death of the behema that creates the isur, it's the psak din, the gemar din. Gemar din is equally applicable to its hair as it is to its body. Even when it's still alive, it's asur bana. So the hair will also be asur bana. So explaining the difference in the outcome or the psak of the Mishnah, that the women's hair is mutar, the woman's hair is mutar, and the behemoth's hair is asur, because the reason for the isur ana is different in each of these two cases. I mean, the way Rav sets it up, he says the cases aren't parallel in the whole situation. Situation's not parallel. One's wearing a wig, and one's with the animal's hair is attached. Nachman Yitzchak says that's unacceptable. The Mishnah contrasts them because it's the exact same case. It's the hair of the animal and the hair of the woman. So they have to be the same physical cases. Gemara's answer is that there's a difference in the din. There's a halachic difference, but not a physical difference. So the Mishnah is still saying that the cases are comparable in terms of their physical circumstances. It says that the outcome is different because of the halachic difference between them. You have to separate between a halachic difference and a physical difference. Tani Levi Kavati Derav, Tani Levi Kavati Derav Nachman. We have a Mishnah or Braito from Levi that is supports Rav's position and the one that supports Rav Nachman Yitzchak's position. Woman has been taken out to be killed, executed. Give my hair to my daughter. Then we give it. If she dies, or if she was neregit, if she was executed, when she dies, you don't give it because the mate is asur ba'ana. Of course, the mate is asur ba'ana. What else would you think? It's not that the mate itself is asur ba'ana, but even the accoutrements of the mate are asur ba'ana. What's accoutrements? They say pe'an achrit, the wig. The wig is an accoutrement of the woman over here, and therefore it's asur ba'ana. Tanya kavete de Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak. We have a braita that supports that explanation of Rav Nachman Yitzchak. Aisha shemeita nehenim b'sara. Be'ema shenerga asura ba'ana. Ma hafresh ben zeh lezeh. Zu mitata osota, zu gemar dina osota. It's exactly the differentiation that Rav Nachman Yitzchak made. It says in both cases we're talking about the hair. Literally the hair of the woman and the hair of the behema. The hair of the woman is mutar, the hair of the behema is asura, and the reason is because of this difference of when the isur ana comes into effect. The behema comes into effect once the psak din is given. For the woman, it goes into effect when she dies. And when she dies, it has no impact on the hair. Gemar din does have impact on the hair. And that will explain the difference, and that supports the position of Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak. Next Mishnah, we begin the perek. Ein ne'arachin pachot misela, velo yoter ha'chamishim sela. Arachin start at a sela and go up to 50 sela. The maximum is 50, the minimum is 1. Ketzer. Natan sela v'heshir, if he gave a sela to pay off, couldn't afford to pay the erach that he said. And he gave one sela to pay for it, and then he got rich, eno ten klum, he's done. He paid off whatever he was supposed to do, and he's done. Pachot misela, if he paid only less than a sela, because that's all he had, and then he got wealthy, no tain chamishim sela, now he has to pay the full freight. That wasn't an equivalent payment, because until you reach the level of a sela or a shekel kodesh, it's not considered as if you paid for the arachin. Hayubi yadav chamesh slaim, if he only had 5 shekel in his hands. Rabbi Meir Omer inotein al achat. He gives one, and that's it. Rabbi Yomim inotein et kulan. He gives all five of them. I'll see in the Gemara what their machloket revolves around. Ein erachim pachot yisel, but the oter al chamishim sel. You don't have erach of less than one and more than 50. It's a repeat of the first line of the Mishnah, and the Gemara asks, why do you need a repeat of that? Say, ein erachim pachot yisel. How do you know that there's no such thing as an erach less than a selah? I mean, Olan, we had this, again, in the Gemara in Bechorot, earlier in this Masechta, we saw it as well. Dichtiv, ko erachacha yeh b'shekel ha-kodesh. The pasuk that says, towards the end of all the redemption issues that brought in Vayikra, Perek of Zayin, says all monies, all values have to be paid b'shekel ha-kodesh. And we dash from that, kol erachin, shata marich. Any erach that you assign a value to, lo yeh b'chutim yishekel, could be no less than a shekel. And not more than 50, dichtiv 50, because 50 is the largest number that you have in erachin. It's a zachar, a male, between the age of 20 and 60 is 50. So you can't get above 50, and you can't get below one selah. So that explains the first line in the Mishnah. Now, hayu b'yadav chamisha. Now we want to understand over here this machalok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, as if he has five shekel in his hands, why according to Rabbi Meir only pays one, and according to Chachamim he pays all five? My time to Rabbi Meir, k'tiv chamishim v'k'tiv shekel. The Torah lays out for you the way you can pay Erech. Either you pay the 50, which is the full amount that you're assigned, or you pay a shekel, because b'chol Erech ha'yem shekel ha'kodesh. It's one or the other. Torah offers you two options. If you can afford it, you pay the full amount. Now again, the full amount can be many different numbers. Mar is just using the extreme, which is the highest amount, which is the zachar between age of 20 and 60. He's going to pay 50. So if you can afford the 50, and you promise to pay, you pay the 50. If you can't afford it, it's called Heseg Yad. Heseg Yad says you go before the coin, and he determines what you can pay. If he determines that you can't make the full payment of the 50, then you pay one. So there are only two choices here. Pay one or pay 50. Rabbanan, how do chol arachin shata marich lo yeh b'chutim mishekel u'da'ata. The limud from the pasuk of b'chol erachacha b'shekel u'kodesh doesn't mean that it's a payment. That's one form of erach. Erach has 50, it has 3, it has 5, it has all these numbers that come out in the arachin, plus one. So either it's one or 50 in that case. The man says, no, the whole erachah yishek kodesh means that's the minimum amount you can assign to the individual. So, hey, vadit lay. And if he has more than a shekel, the pasuk says, asher tzitzig yado noder. As long as he can pay for it, if he can afford it, he pays it. Even if it's less than 50, even though he took a nether to pay 50, nevertheless, it says, v'imachu merkecha, if he's too low of a payment, v'imido lifnei ha-kohen, v'erich oto ha-kohen, you stand before the kohen, you determine how much you can pay, asher tzitzig yado noder yerkeno ha-kohen. You determine the amount based on how much you can afford. How much you can afford can be more than a selah and less than 50. So Chaim says that it's a range. You can pay anywhere from 1 until 50. Whereas Rabbi Meir sees it as being a choice, a binary option of either 1 or 50. For the Chachamim, it says, Asher tzig ha-noder, v'ari yado maseget, and he's able to afford it. For Rabbi Meir, ha'u yad ha-noder, v'lo yad ha-nidar hu da'ato. That comes to teach you that yad ha-noder, we assign or we determine the amount to be afforded by the one who's taking the nether, not by the object of his nether. Rabbanan la memelu shma mino? Of course you learn that, yes, you're right, we learn that out of the pasuk, but that comes out of memelu from the pasuk. Te'echa de yado maseget, shoko mine. Because the context of the pasuk, he's talking about the affordability of the one who is paying. It's the amount of money that he can pay. Yadoma seged, he pays. But it's clear that, yes, you're right. We're talking about the noder and not the nidar. We're talking about the person making the nether, not the person who was the nether was thinking about. But nevertheless, from the pasuk, you see clearly that it has to do with affordability. Amar Rav Ada Rava, Ayubi Yadav Chamesh Slaim. He has in his hand exactly five selav. Amar Erki Alai. Chazar Amar Erki Alai. He says that I'm paying my value. And then again, he says he's paying my value, or he says, Erko Alai, he says about someone else, I'm paying his value. And again, he repeats it. Benatan Arba L'Shnia, and he pays off the second one first, pays four to the second one, Ve'chad L'Mishona, and then he pays one of those Sela, one of those Shekel HaKodesh, for the first Neder. So he took a Neder Erachin, over here, either of himself twice, or someone else twice. He can't afford the full amount, but then he pays off the second one with four of those Shekel that he has in his hands, and the first one with one Shekel, that he has in hands. The Gemara says he's discharges Yatzah Yadei Shnehem. He's discharged his obligation with regards to both of them. And if he gets rich later on, doesn't matter. He's paid off his erech. Now here the case, obviously, and we're going to see in a second, is where he went to get assessed by the coin for the second one before he went to get assessed for the first one. And the Gemara explains why. My time, huh? What is that work that when he pays four for the second obligation and one for the first obligation that is Yotzei Yadei Shnehem? Because number one, Bal Chov Me'uchar, Shekadam V'Gava, Meshagava, Gava. If a Baal Chov, you have two creditors over here, The second creditor has a subordinated lien. The first creditor is in front of him in terms of lien, but if he goes in and he grabs property, what he took, he took. So it's over here. The second assessment, because it was already paid, what he got, and that's it. Then number two is, bidanan da'iv l'shniya mishubad rishona. Well, if that's the case, then why didn't he give all five to the second one? Because there was still the outstanding obligation of the first creditor. Over here, the first neder of Erech was outstanding, and therefore they had a pull, or they had some rights to that money. If they had rights to the money, then all the money was not available to pay the second party. The first party did have a right to that money, so whatever he paid at the time he paid the second person was all that he could give him, because he still had to have something left over for the first. And then the money left over the first pays off the first. Bidinah da'iv l'shana, too late. And then when he goes to pay off the first creditor, or here the first neder of Arachin, he pays whatever he had left. All he had left was a shekel. And shekel is the minimum amount you need to be yotze, your obligation to pay the erech. So you did that. But the other way around, natan arba l'shana, v'achat l'shnia, if he gives four to the first one, meaning the first neder, or the first creditor, and then one to the second, yidei shnia yatza. As far as the second one is concerned, you'll say your chovah, because that's all you had left. When you came to pay the second one, all you had left in your hand was one shekel, and so you paid everything that you had. That's fine. But yidei rishona lo yatza. The first one, you were not yotzei, because when you went to pay the first obligation, when the kohen assessed you, at that point you had five shekel in your hand. You should have paid all five shekel at that time to the first party. There should have been nothing left for the second party. The fact that you left over for the second party was that you withheld something from the first, and therefore you're not yotzei for the first one, because mishabdim l'rishona. Everything, kulu mishabdim l'yotzeina. The entire amount of money was mishuba to the first party. So by Rav Adar Ba'avo, hayubi yadav chamesh sulayim, v'amar shnei erki alai. The person had only five shekel, like cases we've spoken about until now. And then he says that I take on two times my value. So it's as if he took two nidrei erech, but bevat achat. He's doing it simultaneously. Suppose the case before, where he took them one after the other, but he went for the second assessment before he went for the first assessment. Over here, he took the nedarim together, plus he went for an assessment at the same time. It's really not relevant when he takes the neder. The question is when he stands before the kohen. So when he comes before the kohen, that's the point at which the obligation begins. So the vat achad really is about the assessment period, not about the time of the neder. Ma, kevin the vat achad nadar, since he took the neder together, ki adadi tafsan, they grabbed together. So if tarati apagal hai, but tarati apagal hai, gives two and a half to each. And since their lien was generated simultaneously, they basically split the pot of money that exists there. So they each get two and a half, each erech. Will it be assigned two and a half of the shekel that he has in hand? Or maybe each nether really has a full claim of five on him, and since he doesn't discharge the obligation of either, and then even if you pay two and a half to each of them, you've not discharged your obligation of either of them. And the Gemara leaves that as a teiku. All right, now the last line in the Mishnah, which was repetitive, the Gemara wants to know why. Ain berachim pachot misel v'lo yeter al-chamishim. Ha tu lamali. Why'd you write that again? The last line in the Mishnah indicates like a Stam Mishnah like the Rabbanon, because it says there's nothing below 1 and nothing above 50. The inference that you should draw from that, that there is payment between 1 and 50. And that is like the Shita of the Chachamim, who say that you pay whatever amount you have between the 1 and the 50 that you're able to afford. Whereas Rabbi Meir says there's only two choices, 1 and 50. So this second part of the Mishnah comes to tell you not only the principle, but also to infer from that principle that amounts between them are also good payments, and that's like the Rabbanan, and the Stam Mishnah is like the Rabbanan. Okay, we'll stop over here.